From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific.
Indonesia is a crucial economic partner of Australia. I want to re-emphasise and emphasise 1,000 times to the Australian business community that this is a very large emerging market for Australia, and it's time we actually rose to the challenge and the opportunity. Of course, I'll also be discussing with the Indonesian government our security relationship and associated questions of border security.
Kevin Rudd has left for Indonesia on his first overseas trip since taking back the Australia Prime Ministership. He plans to discuss free trade deals and live cattle export quotas during his talks with the Indonesian president, but the electorally sensitive issue of asylum seekers is likely to overshadow the visit, and that some interest groups are worried. Mr. Rudd has spoken to the press ahead of his trip, saying Australia is committed to maintaining good, strong relations and economic strategic ties with Indonesia. So what's the perception of Kevin Rudd in Australia? Joanna McCarthy spoke to Tim Lansley, chairman of the Australian-Indonesian Institute and director of the Melbourne Law School Centre for Indonesian Law, Islam and Society.
Kevin Rudd's well known in Indonesia. He's also quite well liked in Indonesia. The former Prime Minister, John Howard, for whatever reason, was not popular in Indonesia, and Rudd's defeat of Howard gave him quite a degree of credibility. The fact that he's known to President Yudhoyono already and that they have a good working relationship from the past means that he will find it fairly easy to interact with the Indonesian government. And it's fair to say generally, however, that any Australian government now would find it reasonably easy to interact with the current president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, because he clearly has an interest in Australia and a willingness to work to strengthen the bilateral relationship. And that would be true if a Liberal government came to power too.
There has always been a nervousness in Jakarta about support for Papuan independence groups within Australia. Now Melissa Park, who is a supporter of such groups, has been appointed to the aid portfolio by Kevin Rudd. Is that something that's likely to cause tensions or sensitivities?
Not necessarily in itself. The issue is sensitive. There are popular perceptions in Indonesia that Australia or the Australian public would support independence in eastern Indonesia for various groups, secessionist groups. But it is pretty clear that Australian governments, and this is a bipartisan position, support Indonesian sovereignty over Papua, and that's also understood in Indonesia. So whilst the official position of the Australian government on Papua is understood and accepted, there is a lingering sort of suspicion that Australians have sympathies with separatists. Now, that makes this issue always one, again, that needs management. But again, I think we shouldn't exaggerate it. The real issues would arise if there was extreme human rights violations in Papua and popular opinion in Australia forced an Australian government to react. And that would then play into memories of Australia's involvement in East Timor's independence. And that would be quite damaging to the relationship.
Finally, Tim Lindsay, you would have seen the recent Lowy poll found that only a third of Australians agree that Indonesia is a democracy. In the Australian media narrative around boats and tourists in Bali and live cattle exports, are Australians missing out on the full Indonesian story?
Undoubtedly. Indonesia went from being a military-backed autocracy in 1998 when Suharto fell to being one of the only genuine multi-party democracies in Indonesia. It's also one of the few states in East Asia that has a genuinely completely free press and an open society. Now, let's not overlook the problems that Indonesia has, real problems with corruption, real problems with ineffective law enforcement, an incomplete transition to an open democratic society, but it has taken huge strides forward. It is a completely different place to what it was before 1998. One of the real tragedies, I think, of Australia's involvement in its own region is that it simply has not noticed the transformation that's taken place in Indonesia, both political and economic, with Indonesia almost unaffected by the GFC. Now, it's hard to explain why this is, but part of it at least has to do with a continuing stream of bad news stories that dominate our perception, from the tsunami to the drugs trials of Australians to avian flu and SARS to a range of other terrorist attacks and so forth in Indonesia. And this has created a perception of Indonesia as a sort of broken, dangerous place. The Lowy polls say that Australians think of Indonesia in similar terms to countries like North Korea and Iraq and Afghanistan, which is just frankly ridiculous. So with Indonesia booming, opening up, moving forward, we've closed down at the same time in our linkages. Australians knew Indonesia better when it was a military autocracy than when it's a democracy. Another factor in this, of course, and it's linked to the very negative perceptions, is the collapse of Indonesian studies in Australia. The Department of Education, Employment and Workplace Relations about 3 years ago predicted that on current trends, Indonesian language would be wiped out in our schools within about 8 years. That gives about 5 years more before it's gone, and the universities will follow pretty soon after, as other studies have shown. So what's going to happen when we have one of the only other multi-party democracies in the region, one of the only places with free press, and we can no longer speak that language or understand it? It's in terms of national strategy and positioning ourselves for the Asia century, it makes the white paper look a little absurd, I think.
Professor Tim Lindsay, Chairman of the Australian Indonesia Institute and Director of the Melbourne Law School Centre for Indonesian Law, Islam and Society, speaking with Joanna McCarthy. Fiji police are not commenting on an investigation into a video showing an unidentified Fiji security personnel torturing two men. The video appeared on the internet 5 months ago, and despite announcing an investigation at the time, Fiji police have said nothing about it. Earlier this week, Assistant Commissioner Rosto Tarev told the local media that he would be saying nothing about the investigation into the torture video until they had completed it. Human rights organization Amnesty International says they have no evidence that an investigation is actually being carried out. Bruce Hill picks up the story.
Yeah, voila.
Oh, hello, Mr. Tundravo. It's Bruce Hill here from ABC Radio Australia. Just letting you know I'm recording this. We wondered if you could tell us a bit about this investigation into the torture video.
No, I don't have any comment for that.
Why is that?
No comment.
Well, is there any evidence that there is an investigation? Some people have said there is no investigation.
No comment.
There is a bit of concern about this in the Pacific as well as in Fiji.
No comment.
Can I ask you, have you been told to say no comment, or is it your decision? Have you been ordered to do this? Fiji Assistant Police Commissioner Rusianti Tundravu. The lack of progress with the investigation is frustrating some Fiji opposition politicians. One of them, former opposition leader Mick Beddoes, says this needs to be looked at urgently.
I think it's extremely important. I mean, what we have here is a case where an extensive investigation is not really required, because everything was there on video for everybody, for the world to see. And it shouldn't have been too difficult to, you know, put the pieces together and go after the various people involved. The only reason I can think of that they're not wanting to comment, or they're not saying anything about it, is because they can't say anything about it, because the facts are as clear as daylight for everybody to see, that this is a clear case of abuse, and it is a sanctioned abuse from the highest authority in the regime.
Is there anything that politicians can do about this in the normal working of the political process? This would come up and be an issue and be discussed?
Oh, I have no doubt that the actual heavy-handed treatment that the authorities have been dishing out, particularly the video that we're talking about, this will all come back when we return to democratic rule, and those people who were responsible or part of this will be brought to account. They must account for their wrongdoing, and that's the only way things are going to turn out for the better in Fiji. The problem we have here is we've had coups, and those people who have been responsible for these coups that have caused all the suffering in this country get off scot-free, and they don't account for their wrongdoing. So this has to change. Those people who take this kind of action And those people who support them, knowingly support them, must face the music. You know, they say, you want to do the crime, then you need to do the time.
Concern about the lack of progress with the investigation into the torture video is not limited to Fiji. Grant Baildon, head of Amnesty International New Zealand, says it's an issue that won't go away.
Well, we're certainly disappointed that the Fiji police haven't come out with any fresh news or more information. This video came to light right back in February, and at the time the police promised an investigation. Now, it's many months on. We still haven't had any information back on progress on that. So we're really beginning to doubt what's actually happening on this investigation in Fiji.
Is there any evidence that an investigation is in fact underway? They did say when this video first surfaced they would undertake it, but then we haven't heard anything. It's been 5 months now.
Well, Amnesty International hasn't heard anything, and we also haven't had any response to other issues that we've raised with the Fiji police. So 9 credible allegations of torture of recaptured prisoners through last year, still no response to any of those credible allegations.
The Fiji police did say a couple of days ago in the local media that they wouldn't be answering any questions about this until the results of the investigation were through. Is that a reasonable response, do you think?
The key thing for an investigation like this is that it needs to be open, and it needs to be transparent, and it needs to be independent. And they need to be seen to be doing those things. So we'd expect by now that the Fiji government would have a proper update on progress on this investigation so that they can give their people confidence that they're following through.
If this doesn't happen, though, is there anything that can be done? If there is no investigation, if there are no results from this, is this just going to go away?
Well, Amnesty International will certainly continue to work on it. We have a number of concerns about human rights in Fiji. This is one of those, and we'll keep pushing it. Also, the international community will be encouraging to keep raising this issue. The New Zealand and Australian and other governments need to make sure that rule of law is observed in Fiji.
But if the Fiji government or the police just don't do an investigation, as appears that they're on the surface that they're not, really, can anything be done to make them? Or is this, if they don't do it, is that just the end of the story?
Well, it's very hard to force the Fiji government to do that. But what we can do is to keep working on this. People can make their views known to the Fiji government, and other governments in the region can too. We've seen in the past that can be a very powerful force for change. So Amnesty International is certainly not giving up on this issue.
Australia's new Minister for International Development, Melissa Park, has refused to comment on how her appointment would be viewed in Indonesia. Last year, Ms. Park defied a request from the acting foreign minister, Craig Emerson, to boycott a meeting on the disputed province of West Papua. The former United Nations human rights lawyer says her focus is on aid. We have this story from Indira Morola.
Melissa Park's support for groups involved in West Papuan independence is likely to be a touchy subject in Indonesia, the country that is also Australia's biggest recipient of bilateral aid. But in her first interview since taking responsibility for Australia's aid budget, she has refused to be drawn on how that support might impact her relationship with her Indonesian counterparts.
Well, I mean, that's just not an issue that I'm going to canvass.
She says it won't create conflict in her new role.
My focus is on the aid program. And we are doing fantastic things together with the Indonesian government in education, for instance. We're building and renovating 2,000 junior secondary schools. We're training 300,000 principals. And we're going to have thousands and thousands of young Indonesians who will be receiving a mainstream secular curriculum education. And I think that's got to be a good thing for all of us.
$375 million a year has now been assigned to fund asylum seekers, money taken from Australia's aid budget. But Ms. Park defends this decision.
Our aid program is about saving lives. It's about making a contribution to helping people who are suffering poverty, disease, war, unrest. So it's not only the right thing to do, but it's also the smart thing to do. And can I say that this Labor government has increased our aid commitment every year since we've been in government. This year, $500 million increase over the previous year. And we are absolutely committed to the 0.5% of GNI target. And that commitment has been pushed out to 17-18, but the commitment is rock solid.
And in what his critics have said is a move to the right, Prime Minister Rudd has said many of those granted asylum in Australia are in fact economic migrants. Ms Park explains how she thinks the government should move forward in addressing the issue of asylum seekers.
What I think is the appropriate way forward is the one that was set forth by the Houston panel, which is that we absolutely need to work on the basis of the regional framework. This is a global problem, it's a regional problem. We're not going to solve it on our own. We have to solve it in cooperation with countries in our region.
And she makes the point that Papua New Guinea will continue to be a priority for Australian aid.
PNG is one of our priority countries. It has to be. Our whole region is a priority region because 18 of our 20 closest neighbours are developing countries. And we know that PNG is facing massive issues when it comes to gender inequality and domestic violence, when it comes to literacy and health. We know that there's a long way to go in places like PNG and other countries that we're assisting, but we're on the right track.
And another newly sworn-in minister, Richard Miles, in the trade portfolio, will also turn at least some of his attention to the Pacific, attempting to make progress in the slow-moving PACER Plus negotiations.
We saw very significant advances at the ministerial meeting in Majuro and the Marshall Islands this time last year, and we'll be hopeful to continue that momentum at the ministerial meeting in Apia in Samoa later this month. It's a really important agreement, as much in a trade sense as it is actually in a development sense, because for the small island countries of the Pacific, having access to the economies of both New Zealand and Australia is really important in terms of providing opportunities for development for these countries, which is why it is such an important piece in the context of development. It's also why development contributions are a significant part of the PACER Plus arrangement. That's in a sense what the plus is the development side of it. So I actually hold out quite a lot of optimism about PACER Plus, and I'd be very hopeful that the upcoming ministerial meeting maintains that momentum.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The Philippines is one of the top five labor exporters in the world, and last year Filipinos overseas sent back more than $20 billion, or 9% of the country's GDP. But those remnants didn't come from all contract workers. In fact, emigres played a big role in giving money back to the Philippine economy. Simona Denny reports now from Manila on how money from Filipinos abroad makes its way back home.
Hill Lebria is from Davao City in the country's south, but these days he spends a lot of time at this house in Metro Manila. It's the headquarters of Migrante International, an advocacy group for migrant workers. Mr. Lebria has been going to government agencies in Manila that help place workers overseas. He says throughout his 13 years as a logistics officer, mostly in the Middle East, he had bad contracts and he hardly ever got paid on time. Still, Mr. Lebria sent about $500 home every month.
I always borrow money from other Filipino just working in other company to sustain my family. Because my family is always need the money or daily financials.
Mr. Lebria's situation is pretty typical, according to Mick Katwira, a Migrante caseworker. He says a significant number of Filipinos who leave for work have next to nothing.
It's nearly impossible for Filipinos to disregard the needs of their family. Most of them would sacrifice having to take out loans with high interest. Like it could go as high as 30%.
The story is a little different for Filipinos who emigrate permanently. At the Commission on Filipinos Overseas in Manila, Rodrigo Garcia heads a policy research team. The commission tracks Filipino emigres and helps prepare individuals and families for life overseas. Mr. Garcia says sending money home is not just for practical purposes. The act of sending is ingrained in the Filipino psyche.
It is assumed, especially by your extended family, that once you're there, you have to give something. Well, that's the case there. You have to give something, or else those loved ones of yours will think not less of you, but they will think that something's wrong with them, that you have forgotten them.
Mr. Garcia says emigres usually send money a few times a year, which is what Jaime Flores, a naturalized American citizen, does. Mr. Flores moved to the United States 42 years ago on a whim. He was a certified public accountant in the Philippines, and when he was on vacation there, he decided to apply for a work visa. Mr. Flores qualified, worked as an accountant, and occasionally sent money home. Today, he's retired and still sends birthday money.
And then in Christmas, then I send them $400. It's just a token gift. It's not to sustain them, you know, because they're able to sustain themselves.
Mr. Garcia says of more than 9 million Filipinos abroad, there are slightly more emigres than contract workers. There's no government data to show what their money pays for, but he says there's anecdotal evidence from real estate developers that emigres are a significant clientele.
250.
Jaime David is one of those. He takes a few moments to talk on the phone from his Oriental grocery store in Chicago. Mr. David's family, plus his parents and all his siblings, live across the U.S., but he's planning for retirement in the Philippines. Mr. David rents out properties in Manila and a nearby province. The more than $1,200 he receives is deposited in a local bank.
We keep it there. And then so that when we go home, we have money to spend there. I don't bring too much money from here.
For years, the commission believed the majority of remittances came from immigrants because the Philippine Central Bank's figures show the biggest amount is from the U.S., which has the most Filipino emigres. But the bank clarified recently that money sent from overseas, especially the Middle East, passes through headquarter banks in the U.S. There are more than 2 million contract workers in the Middle East. Gil Lebria, the contract worker, hopes to avoid the Middle East altogether for his next job. He recently trained as a skilled butcher.
In Canada, Australia, or in America, after 4 years contract in butcher, you get a permanent visa. Otherwise, you can particular a citizen. So that is a big opportunity because there is no opportunity here in the Philippines.
Whether it's to work overseas or to emigrate, about 4,000 Filipinos leave every day.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, please contact us. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. If you wish to listen to this edition of the program again, as well as all past editions, check out our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. If you'd like to listen to another edition of Focus Asia Pacific, you can do that on Sundays at 1330 UTC on PCJ Radio International's transmission to Southeast and East Asia on 11835 kHz. That's 11835 kHz at 1330 UTC. And that edition of Focus Asia Pacific is presented by Andy Sennett. We're going to leave you with a little bit of music today from Singapore. The singer's name is Stephanie Sun, and this is her latest hit called Perfect. So until next time, friends, we'll see you in 7 days' time. Have a great weekend. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Bob Zanotti. Do you miss Swiss Radio International? If so, I invite you to visit my website, SwitzerlandInSound.com. Colorful and informative radio features about Switzerland, its destinations, interesting people, politics, culture, and even the two Bobs. SwitzerlandInSound.com, where English language radio from Switzerland lives on.
Hi, I'm Peter Anthony Holder, and I would like you to join me for a very eclectic and different kind of radio show. It's called the Stuff File Program. Where else would you get to hear a well-renowned Hollywood acting teacher, a best-selling science fiction writer, a guy who teaches llamas how to be golf caddies, or the man who has Hitler's toilet, all wrapped up with some of the oddest news stories around? It's a rhetorical question. There's only one place. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. There are various ways to catch the show. You can find it at my website at peteranthonyholder.com. Check out my blog at peteranthonyholder.blogspot.com. Find it at cyberstationusa.com, radioforall.net, or simply subscribe to it on iTunes. You've forgotten all those places already, haven't you? Okay, just Google the title. It's called The Stuff File Program, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. Catch it, enjoy it, and have a chuckle or two. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Radio will never be the same again.